Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're back talking to an old friend. And I can rest assure you, my old friend, it's not you, Martin.
Oh, that was a good one. You must have planned that all week.
I planned that about 15 minutes ago, folks, because he was driving me mad trying to log in, and I'm gonna get that anyway. Look, just to let listeners know, delighted today, we put out a small taster for the upcoming Tortoise Shack podcast in collaboration with the Starling Collective, also with the Tenny Network, and it's called Conversay Trans, and it's conversations hosted by trans people, for trans people, with trans people. And we're delighted that the Tortoise Shack is going to be collaborating with them, and we're delighted that it's actually that it's now in the world. So keep an eye out for Conversay Trans. Look at the Tortoise Shack. It's up on Patreon right now. It was just brilliant to be doing it and brilliant to be involved. So it's always really, really nice to see.
It's great to have the diversity of voices on and to have trans people talking about trans people rather than other people talking about trans people. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, no, and thanks to so many people involved. But I do want to thank Caroline West from Glow West for actually dragging me out of my comfort zone to get involved with the project. Reminder, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Anyway, enough of that. We are rejoined on the podcast, as I said, by an old friend, Fred Logue of FP Logue, the principal of FP Logue. Fred, how have you been?
Not too bad. Surviving. For some bizarre reason, I've been as busy in the last year as I've ever been. Which is nice to have.
A good complaint, Fred. A good complaint.
It is.
Actually, funnily enough, myself and Martin meant to go back to you in December to do how the year that was, and then, you know, ideas for 2021. And we just got bloody flooded with events, dear boy, events. But you've been a busy boy. And, you know, recently there has been a ruling, and you might want to give our listeners an idea around the topic of wind farms and that you've been heavily involved in and what that actually means in terms of the environmental law.
Yeah, that's an interesting case. It's a case taken by Right to Know, an information rights, information access NGO that's run by Ken Fox and Gavin Sheridan. Mm-hmm. And it's taken under a special regime for access to environmental information. So information about the environment, about factors affecting the environment. And it's designed to give the public a greater transparency about things that affect, that are relating to the environment. And it comes from the Aarhus Convention, which is international law that provides for access to information, public participation, and access to justice rights in relation to environmental decision-making. So the principle of access to environmental information is that public authorities are legally obliged to give access to information. They're also legally obliged to actively publish environmental information, and they're supposed to help the public get access to that information. Now, the interesting thing about the Aarhus Convention is that what is a public authority is defined in functional rather than formal terms. So it's less important that it's privately owned or publicly owned. It's more important that about what it does or what its functions are. And if there's a public function, then in general, it's a public authority. So that's meant to take into account that, particularly in kind of Western countries or countries like our own, a lot of public services are now being privatized or outsourced or otherwise kind of handed over in some greater or lesser extent to public and private entities like companies. But that's not the deciding factor. So, for example, in Ireland, the way we've implemented our wind energy strategy is to allow private developers to build wind farms subject to licenses and authorizations by the Commission for the Regulation of Utilities. And then they sell that or put that into the national grid for sale to suppliers. And the idea behind that kind of the way that the system is structured is to allow for better security and a more integrated or greater integrity to the electricity system. So you're not just depending on a big bloated state monopoly. You can let market forces and entrepreneurs be involved, but but at the same time, it's quite highly regulated. And that ensures that there's a good electricity system in Ireland and in the European Union. So the interesting thing about that is, though, is that when somebody builds a wind farm, they get an authorization to construct the wind farm off the Commission for Regulation of Utilities. And what comes with that is they get a CPO power, so the power to compulsorily acquire land or rights over land if it's needed. And the idea behind that, again, is that the national grid or the electricity grid or power stations is a public interest in building those. So it shouldn't be up to somebody who's building an electricity infrastructure to have to negotiate with every single landowner. I think you can imagine that it would be impractical if you wanted to run an electricity wire halfway across the country to have to sit down and do a private negotiation with every single landowner on the route. So for that reason, the ESB traditionally has had very broad rights to access land and to acquire land and to put up electricity infrastructure without having to get agreement from the landowner. And then when the electricity market was unbundled, some of those powers were given to private entities that built wind farms or other power stations under the supervision of the Commissioner for Regulation of Utilities. So that's kind of the background. And in the EU, in the UK, again, they have a privatized system for water, sewerage, utility provision. And there's a case called Fish Legal, where a fishing charity wanted to get access to information held by water companies in the UK, which have similar powers to electricity generators here. And this went all the way to the ECJ, that said that a body like that, a private body that's providing a public service or is essentially providing a utility, is a public authority if it's been given special powers that normal private entities don't have. So I think it's fairly easy to imagine that a normal company, a regular company, can't go and compulsorily acquire somebody's land. So the CPO power is by definition, or is a classic special power. So, and the reason it's important is because there's a particular controversy over noise, particularly from wind farms. And most wind farms have planning conditions that requires the noise output to be monitored, so that the local authority or whoever can check that they're not exceeding the noise thresholds that are set down in the planning permission. So most wind farms have continuous noise monitoring, and the data is recorded. So people are trying to get it from local authorities, who say they don't store it; they just look at it and then delete it. Publicly owned wind farms, such as this one in the case called Raheenley, which is owned by Caolte and ESB. Caolte, they will say, well, it's owned by a company that we don't have access to it. We can't control that company. It's a private company. So 3 or 4 years ago, Right to Know put a request into Caolte looking for noise information relating to a wind farm located in the Wicklow Mountains called Raheenley. And they were told by Caolte that Caolte didn't have most of the information. It was held by a company called Raheenley Power DAC, and they couldn't get it. So Right to Know said, right, that's grand. So they looked up Raheenley, sent them an email, and asked Raheenley to give it to him. Funnily enough, the email was answered by somebody from the ESB. Their registered office is at the ESB's office. The company has no employees. ESB provides most of the services. And it's ESB's legal department is the contact details for them. But we were told they're completely independent of ESB. The ESB couldn't get that information, or they couldn't, and they wouldn't give it to us because they were a private company and not a public authority.
That's bizarre.
So the next step was a complaint or an appeal to the Commissioner for Environmental Information, who is like the Information Commissioner, but specifically for AIE appeals. And he made a decision saying, actually, Raheenley Power is not a public authority because it's a private company. And anyway, electricity is no longer a public service. It's been privatized, which I think that would come as news to most people to think electricity isn't a public service.
I think it would. God, that's very strange, Fred. That's very strange.
When you think all the debates recently are saying, well, you know, and I go back to even broaden it out to the global debate saying, well, monitor social media like a public utility now, please. But lo and behold, we're told actually public utilities aren't public utilities anymore. That's a bit bizarre.
Yeah, it was. So Right to Know appealed that to the High Court. And shortly after the appeal, the Commissioner for Environmental Information said that they wanted to withdraw their decision. So they settled the case. It went back to the Commissioner, who made a new decision, basically finding the same result, but with more expanded reasons. So that was appealed again. It went through the High Court process. There was a hearing in November of last year, and a decision came out Monday of last week that said, actually, yeah, Raheem Lee Power is a public authority. And by implication, every other generating station in Ireland, and there's 400 of them, are public authorities. And the court said fairly comprehensively that, yes, electricity generation supply, that's a public service. And they do have special powers because they can compulsorily acquire land. It doesn't matter how many there are. That's just the way we've chosen to set up our system. And not only that, that the ESB was in control of this company because it was by then a 50% shareholder. And that it was definitely a public authority. So we were quite happy with that. I think that's a very significant result.
When did they decide to go from being totally ESB to, I don't know, how would you describe a company that's not really a company, Fred?
Well, it's EU driven. So the electricity market was unbundled in the mid to late 90s. And what that means is they separated out the functions of generation, supply, and the operation of the national grid. So Airgrid was set up to own the national grid, and there's a separation in ESB between the part of ESB that supplies electricity, which is called Electric Ireland now, and ESB Networks, which has responsibilities in relating to national grid, to metering and things like that. And then they unbundled the market. That was the unbundling of the market. And then they opened up the market for generation to private operators who can build wind farms or, you know, private gas-fired power stations and things like that. And they also opened up the consumer supply to competition. So now you have like Energy, SSA, Airtricity, Electric Ireland, and so on. So like overall, that's not a bad thing or not a negative thing. It ensures that we have a continuity of supply, that there's competition. But at the same time, it also ensures that our network, the grid, is maintained and is the integrity is preserved, and that there's not a conflict of interest between somebody who owns the network and somebody who's trying to access it. So not dissimilar to what happened in telecommunications, 10 years earlier.
Fred, on the wider issue, and I know this probably might not be your bailiwick, but you mentioned, you know, the competition of for these roles, but we've spoken to people who are in the position of, you know, trying to actually encourage Ireland down to line our West Coast and out into the sea with wind turbines in effect and look at these other things. You're talking about the environmental impact of these, and I know you've mentioned the Aarhus Convention, and we've been lucky to speak to Attracta Evrin about, you know, some of the things that these are problems we've had in relating to, say, for example, what we loosely term Pippa Hackett's bill in terms of people's rights to actually take cases against these things. Does this give people more of a footing on an environmental basis to object to some of these things?
Well, it does. Yeah. So the idea behind access to information is that there's transparency and accountability around environmental issues. So if, for example, the wind farm is exceeding its noise output and that's damaging somebody's health or whatever, they can get the information and exercise their rights. Either they can make a complaint to the local authority because the planning conditions aren't being observed, or if their health is suffering or whatever, they can take a case for damages, for nuisance or whatever. But in the absence of that information, it's much harder for them to exercise their rights, because they're completely in the dark. So that's the idea behind it. And also, under the Aarhus Convention, the cost of litigation can't be prohibitively expensive.
Yeah.
So Ireland is a very high cost regime, I don't think that's not controversial. So for most ordinary people, for most ordinary businesses, it would be financially ruinous to lose a case because they would be faced with a six-figure cost bill to pay the other side's costs, not just their own cost, but the other side's cost. So the Aarhus Convention, and this is why Right to Know can take these cases and other people can take these cases, is that if you do lose, you don't have to pay the other side's costs, except in very exceptional circumstances. And even if those exceptional circumstances apply, the amount of costs you have to pay can't be prohibitive. So the idea is that through litigation, the public authorities are kept in check, that the law is applied uniformly and correctly. And the idea behind like the administrative appeal or the judicial appeal is that there's checks and balances to ensure that happens. And this huge pressure now to cut down judicial review and planning cases, because people are taking cases and winning them. And that's upsetting property developers' financial interests. And you're seeing a lot more, a lot better quality environmental litigation in general in this country because of the access to justice provisions that come in through EU law and through the Aarhus Convention.
Fred, the Raheely business, that you said that model's replicated 400 times, or is it different partnerships 400 times throughout the country?
Yeah, so if you can go onto the Commission for Regulation of Utilities website and do a search for the list of entities that are authorized to build power stations. And I think the last time I looked, there's about 400 of them. So some of them are public, some of them are private, like some are owned by the ESB, but a lot of them are owned by private entities. So they wouldn't traditionally be seen as being part of the state or being a public authority or have to access information and stuff like that. So that's why the decision is so significant.
Is the construct, the way that it's set up with the ESB, is that considered unusual?
No, I don't think there's anything wrong with it per se. That we do have a separation of functions within the ESB.
But the fact that particular company worked, you know, that it was the ESB legal department that you dealt with, that there was no employees, is that strange, or is that sort of par for the course?
It's par for the course because I think as far as I know, they set up SPVs for financial purposes, reasons. So for tax and financing. Okay. And obviously it can be sold off. So originally it was a joint venture between Quilta and ESB. But I think about a year or two ago, Quilta sold its stake to a private equity fund. So now it's only half owned by the ESB.
I know this is taking you off topic, but I just would like to know that you've shown how European case law in the Aarhus Convention, you know, they're making these things not prohibitive for people to challenge. And yet we've seen on the other side, the environmental NGOs raging against government bills that have actually been passed to actually make, you know, the idea of appealing certain things more difficult. And we know what impact that could have on forestry, what impact that could have indeed on wind farms as well, because they're starting to take into account that monoculture, for example, the differences, the problems that can have. And, you know, that takes in aspects, not just of environmental impact, but also of mental health and those other things. Do you think we're facing any interesting, are we going to come into trouble here when the next cases start to boil up? Because it is only going one way with the wind farms. They are going to be rolled out a lot more than they are currently.
Yeah, well, I think wind farms, you know, that's kind of, you know, the key litigation in wind farms has happened. There's fewer and fewer wind farms. And wind farm developers, by and large, are building good, decent projects. Mm. The environmental assessments are good. They realize that it's better business for them to do proper assessments and build environmentally sustainable wind farms rather than risk ending up in the High Court. And so the fight now has moved on to strategic housing development. And you're probably seeing in the papers, Frank McDonald had an article there over the weekend. And so this is, you know, there's people. Some people have done research to show that there was a very strong developer influence in the way the legislation was enacted, And a consequence of that is that a lot of the procedures are actually are likely to be in breach of EU law. So it was designed to minimize public participation and to basically limit the public's participation until right at the end, and then to have a set time to make a decision, literally 11 weeks after the submissions come in. So, there's other provisions that lets developers try and breach county development plans. So, for example, there was one in the paper yesterday in Blanchardstown where the development plan says that it's in a housing estate, essentially. The maximum height is 3 stories. But somebody applied for a 5-story building, and a Bord Pleanála said that's grand. So if you live in a house, in your 3-bedroom, semi-detached, 2-story house, and you think, based on what your local councillors have voted for, that the most they can build across the road from you is a 3-story building, you'd probably be happy enough with that. But then suddenly out of the blue, somebody comes in and puts in a 5-story student accommodation with 200 bed spaces.
I'll go one better, Fred, because this has happened in the last few weeks, and Orla Hegarty warned us about it, that when the development with Bartra was done on O'Devney Gardens, they tendered at whatever it was, say, let's just throw the number out there, 550 units, and they'll get that through, they'll approve it. And we know the financing was disastrous, and they're getting the land for nothing. And I can go through the deal all you want, but I saw a Fine Gael councillor boasting that Bartra was helping resolve the housing crisis, boasting on social media openly by increasing the number by nearly 150 more units.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what does that mean? It means they've gone up higher and they've packed in more. It's just insane.
And they've poor, lower quality apartments.
Absolutely.
So anecdotally, I'm hearing that developers are going in with, you know, reasonable applications into consultations with the local authority or the board. And they're being told to increase the numbers by 50 or 100%. A lot of the controversy over SHDs is just gross overdevelopment. So that means higher buildings, poorer quality, higher buildings in the cities, or even in kind of edge of cities, and then sprawl into the countryside, exceeding the numerical limits on development in kind of rural towns up and down the country. So where they don't have the capacity, they don't have the infrastructure to absorb that level of housing sprawling into the countryside. The great thing now, so the interesting thing about SHDs is that there has been a phenomenal amount of judicial review. So 1 in 8 of SHDs that have been granted have been judicially reviewed. 1 in 10 of the number of grants have been quashed. So 10% of all positive decisions made by the board are unlawful. They breach the law in some respect. And the board has only won one judicial review out of about 20 so far. Two have been settled and the rest have been conceded or lost. So this is compared to normal planning judicial reviews, this is a factor of 10 in terms of the number of judicial reviews. It's a factor maybe more than 10 in the chances of success. So when you hear about judicial reviews holding up development, what's actually happening in SHDs is the judicial review is exposing some very serious issues with the legislation, with the procedure, and with the quality of decision making. So the questions that we should be asking is, what the hell is going on here? Why are there so many judicial reviews? Why are so many succeeding? And why isn't anybody doing anything about it? And it shows the benefit of judicial review for clarifying the law and to make sure that administrative decision makers follow the law when they're asked to do it. Because, you know, politicians can be lobbied. Even administrative decision makers, you know, have an eye on policy or the prevailing winds. But the judiciary can't be lobbied. They're completely independent. And their job is to apply the law objectively and apply European law. So. And I have a tracker, you might put up a link to it, of the SHDs. So you can see what's happening in real time, the number of decisions, number of applications, the results, what's happening. And it's showing, it's really significant to see this, just the dynamics of it. And there's about 10 pending cases that'll be heard between now and July that will look at some very significant aspects of whether or not the SHD legislation itself is compatible with EU law.
And is there any concern on the other side? I mean, they seem to be very flahoolock with this, Fred. If you're winning so many cases, is there any concern on the other side that the model is broken and they should be looking at it a different way?
That I don't know. I think what you'll find is developers will be lobbying politicians to make sure people can't take cases. And essentially, that just means that they're lobbying for unlawful decisions to be let stand. I think that the system can be fixed if there's proper consultation between all stakeholders, and we can get a procedure that works for developers, that works for and works for communities, and that does deliver planning permission and housing in a timely manner.
And costly manner as well, because this is one of the other key issues. I'm sorry to cut in there, Fred, but it's crucial we do this, because we've seen it this week again, recognised finally by Dublin City Council, that there's a huge disparity between 383,000 per unit and 185,000 according to the Irish government's economic evaluation service. So their own report is saying we can do it for 200,000 less. And now I've actually seen members of the government who've been in government since 2011 saying, oh, we should look into that now. It seems a bit strange.
Well, we're all old enough to remember the last boom.
Yeah.
And in that boom, the more houses we built, the more expensive they got.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's happening again. The more planning permissions are given out, the more expensive the units get. And I'm not an economist. I can't explain that. But, Killian Woods in the Business Post has done a lot of analysis on the actual delivery.
Yeah,
and I think the delivery of housing compared to the number of permits that have been granted, there's quite a big gap between those two numbers.
Yeah, Mel Reynolds put out some facts and figures. It must be 2 years ago now, Tony.
He still does them every quarter. You just don't read them.
But he was saying that in 40 years, the supply has never followed, the price has never followed supply and demand, ever.
No.
Yeah. And it doesn't follow. It just simply does not follow.
It followed once as we approached the top of the boom and everything collapsed. We were still going up in supply, and then all of a sudden the economy tanked. That's the only time in the history of the state where an increase in supply has reduced prices of housing in this state. It just has not happened in 100 years in the history of the state, and it's not happening now. It's really not happening now for several reasons. But as Fred points out, this process is problematic. And I'll add to that process the fact that the state is a big player in terms of what it does and how it a lot of the builds are in the build to rent market. So there's a lot of problems with it. But we've managed to, as Lorcan Sir points out, reduce home ownership by over 35 years in less than 10 years. Which is a phenomenal achievement if that's what you're into. We shouldn't be. Fred, by all means, please send me what you have. We'd love to add it to the blurb for if people want to click through and have a read. This next year, what's on the agenda that we should be banging drums for?
Well, I think we're going to see the SHD legislation just fall apart over the next 6 months. It'll become unworkable. There'll be a whole lot of pipeline projects that'll have to be refused, if I'm right. I could be wrong, but that's my prediction, because I see fundamental issues with EU law, and there'll be a lot of complaining about that, I think. It's inevitable it'll be spun then to say the housing crisis has just got worse because of planning permissions being refused. I think that's going to take a year or two to work through the system. The other thing I'm kind of seeing in my own practice is that people are coming to Ireland, or international NGOs are starting to look at Ireland as a place to take strategic litigation, which is great, because the Irish state has a policy of encouraging Dublin as a location for litigation. I don't think they imagined that it would be strategic litigation against public bodies, but that's what I there's a few cases that we've taken along those lines that are basically designed not to take challenges against Irish implementations, but to take challenges against EU measures. And the problem is that an NGO can't directly go to the European Court of Justice to challenge an EU act. It has to go to a national court and ask that court to send the case to Luxembourg. And there's procedures for that. So in a case that was decided before Christmas to do with Shannon LNG, my client, Friends of the Irish Environment, made an attempt to have the designation of that project as a European project of common interest, have the question of whether that was valid referred to the ECJ unsuccessfully, mind you. But it did clarify some of the procedures that that apply for these kind of acts that are more at an EU level than at a national level. And I think that's going to develop, particularly since the UK has left the EU. So it's not, you can't go to London or whatever to litigate these cases. And kind of the beauty of our system, even though it's expensive, we have cost protection, and we also have this kind of common law system where the parties are kind of in control of the procedure. So you don't get bogged down in the courts. You can move it along yourself, which means that you can get these cases on and get them heard quite quickly. And then we also have a very good group of judges now who are very familiar with planning, with environmental law, with EU law, who through these cases that myself and others have taken, have built up an experience in how to handle environmental cases. So you don't have to explain it to them every time you go to a hearing. So that expertise, both in lawyers, NGOs, the judiciary, is accumulating. So I think there's a good chance that we'll see a bit more of that over time. And I think that's positive. And it's completely in line with government policy to encourage Dublin as a litigation venue.
Well, it does put us as a small island in the center of the world, but maybe not in the way that phrase was intended.
No.
And Fred, we're glad that you're at the eye of that storm, and yourself and the others that are involved, Kent Fox. It's great to see that you're doing all this litigation and that you're actually winning. I mean, and it's a phenomenal, you have a phenomenal win rate at the moment, phenomenal. Thanks for coming on and explaining all this to us. Hope you keep us up to date during the year. I know you had a very, very busy year last year, which is great news. And we hope that you have another really, really busy year this coming year. Thanks for coming in and having this chat with us, Fred.
Thanks very much, lads.
We'd have to go back to Gavin and Ken as well and keep bashing the drum. Righttoknow.ie, folks. And you know what, actually, throw them a couple of quid. Wouldn't hurt you to put your hands in your pocket and keep the lads... There's a lot of FOIs that go in that we never see that we never see anything about. There's a lot of work that goes on in the background. Gavin does a lot of work. His Visi Legal thing, if it suits you, have a look at that. It's unbelievable the work that they're doing. And also, of course, Fred Logue is doing Trojan work for us. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.